You know, the online world is great for so many things. It's great for making you laugh, it's great for entertainment, and every now and again you come across ideas or people that literally blow your mind. But I still think some of our best thinking happens offline. So join me, Nessa, on Offline Thoughts as I chat about some of the things I think about when I'm not online. I'm really glad you're listening, and I hope you enjoy the episode. So in today's episode, I'd like to talk about identities and what it means to grow up in Europe or the West and feeling in some ways that you do belong there because obviously it's all you've ever known. But in many respects, in micro ways, in large ways, you're always reminded that somehow or another you don't quite fit in. And I have to say, you know, I've had a long journey with this discussion or this topic in general because, you know, I always identified as an African person, even when I grew up. I spent most of my years in Europe since the age of 5 or 6. It's pretty much all I've ever known. But when I'd come across Facebook posts or YouTube videos or articles where people from the diaspora usually were talking about their experiences growing up in European countries and specifically talking about how they didn't really ever feel as though they were fully embraced or fully integrated or were able to feel like all the other European people in the countries they lived in, I in many ways didn't identify because I never really identified as being European in the first place, just because I'd had some pretty large experiences, shall we say, that were very character building. And so I never quite felt as though I'd had the same experiences as the people I, you know, lived with, associated with, I went to school with. It just felt like we're different people, not better or worse or negative or positive, just different. My siblings, I would say, though, probably because they were younger, I guess, because they got here when they were basically like just super, super young, younger than me. And for them, they didn't have, or those experiences that I'd had in my formative years didn't really imprint on them because they were too young to remember those things. So in many ways, you know, having grown up in Ireland, they very much identified as Irish people. They had Irish accents, they had Irish reference points. It was all they'd ever known. And so when people would ask, "Where are you from?" they would not have any cognitive dissonance where they would be juggling, depending on the person, what the answer should be. They would just answer very naturally, "I'm Irish." And while this claiming of this identity really wasn't a problem, and I imagine isn't a problem so much when people are very young, just because you're in spaces where, for example, like teachers in primary schools are very protective, so they'd be very inclusive in how they spoke about things, they would be very careful to not ask certain questions. But as people become older and they go into the workplace, or they're just exposed to newspapers and articles and just what adult European people think, that identity over time can become threatened because they start to realize that how they identify is not the same way in which they are perceived. Now, obviously, for like the older people, for our parents who were born in Rwanda or Nigeria or India, wherever the country may be, they are never going to suffer from that identity crisis because they fully identify as the country where they were born. Because for them, basically all their formative, important life experiences have been formed in their home countries. So they grew up, they went to primary school, they went to secondary school, they went to university, they may have had full lives, they may have gotten married there, they may have started businesses there. And when the situation arises where they have to move for economic reasons or for political reasons or because they're refugees or asylum, that identity is very solid and it's very deeply ingrained. And when they come to Western countries or European countries, they're not trying to feel accepted in the sense that they're trying to become Europeanized, if that's a word, or to be identified as an Afro-European person or a European person. Really, they're coming here to get a new life. They're trying to have a better life for themselves, for their families, and all the other things, all the other questions that the younger generation grapples with about which country they belong to or which identity they should identify with, or what does it mean if they identify with one and not the other. Really, our parents and older people who came as fully fledged adults never really have to grapple with these types of questions. Now, for the younger people, the identity crisis comes because sooner or later, and for some people it's sooner and for some people it's later, they will say, for example, "I am a German person and I'm a Nigerian person." But the white Europeans that they live amongst will never perceive them as that way, because obviously they look different than them, and also they have an idea of what it means to be German, for example, what it means to be English, what it means to be Scottish. And when they're looking at the person, they don't see them as looking as the way that they look, or their aunties look, or their ancestors look. And so they don't accept them as one of their own. On top of that, especially in recent years, but it has always been present to a certain extent, there's always kind of been a very deeply ingrained anti-immigration populist movement in most European countries. Now, obviously, the extent to which it's visible and present and talked about in mainstream media changes over time depending on what the political situation is, but it's always been there to a certain extent. And so when we have situations like Brexit, where people who want to be, like the Brexiteers basically are saying they want out of Brexit for two reasons. They say they don't want to be controlled by non-elected European officials who basically dictate how their lives are, but also a large part of it is also because they say they want quote-unquote control and they want immigration reined in. And really, that's dog whistle politics to talk about how they don't want people of color in their countries. So when they're protesting immigration or the levels of immigration, they're not talking about, you know, white French people or white German people or white Swiss people or white Irish immigrants. They're not. They're specifically talking about black and brown people. And so when you identify as, let's say, Polish, for example, or English, for example, and in your country, you have protests against immigrants, and the immigrants, the pictures they have of immigrants are people who look like you, then of course that destabilizes the extent to which you can identify as Polish or English or whatever the European identity may be. So really, the physical reminder of yourself is always present, and it's always present when you're looking at yourself, by when you're alone in the mirror. But specifically, it's heightened when you're in a family, in a European family's home, where you're sitting around the table, for example, and they've invited you over and you're having dinner together, and it's all very pleasant, except that all of them look a very specific way and you look a very different way. And in those moments, even though you may have the same cultural reference points and you might be very familiar with the food they eat and the music they play and the politics, you can't ever really escape from the fact that you're always going to look physically different than they do. And even just outside the physical differences, you're also just raised different because your parents come from a different place with different cultures and different traditions. And so when it comes to sort of being integrated into the culture you live in, there's just going to be differences. So I had the experience, for example, growing up where I would have to beg and plead for sleepovers, because really our parents, living in an environment where they couldn't be sure that the parents that whose kids you were friends with weren't racist, they didn't want to risk having you sleep over and something potentially happen to you, or even if it wasn't like physical harm that might come to you, they didn't want to risk you being emotionally damaged by people who might not like you, or who might be hostile, or just might not be safe just by the virtue of them being anti-immigrant or racist specifically. And so while other people might casually just say, oh, hey, mom, I'm staying over Siobhan's house, you would really have to plan weeks in advance and like be sweet and reassure them that they're completely safe. And also, they would just have to have met the parent many, many times before that was allowed. That extended to many spheres. It extended to what the expectation was around curfews, where African parents expected you to come home at a very specific time. They wanted you to be home early. So I had the experience of having to be home at 6 p.m. up until I was like 17 years old, because that was what they were used to back home. And for them, they perceived the idea that teenagers were out until like 9 or 10 or 11. They saw that as just insanity. And they really kind of would assume that you're doing no good, that you're doing bad things. For girls specifically, they kind of thought that you were like sleeping around, or that you were a sex worker, or that it just had very negative connotations, because back home, young girls didn't stay out past 6 or 7, and even young men as well were very much regulated in how long they were able to stay outside. And so when it comes to sort of coming together with your European friends and trying to have the same experiences and the same life as them, in many ways it's very constrained, because when you go back home, even if you can pretend, or let's not say pretend, even if you can assimilate fully when it comes to the time you spend with them in school and after school, when you go back home, you know that you're having very different experiences. So again, there's always that balancing act and that cognitive dissonance that comes from knowing that you are very different in very specific ways and very impactful ways, but then having to try so hard to fit in with your European friends because you ultimately want to be accepted and to be treated just as they are, because as far as you're concerned, you've never known anything else. So while your parents can have references to their own childhoods back home and not have to straddle with wanting to fit in, because you don't have an out, because you don't have a reference point about back home, really this is all you have. And so you try your hardest to try and make that work or try and make that square fit into a circle. And then a final reason why you're not accepted by your quote-unquote home country is that insofar as you are being socialized different because you have parents who've had wildly different experiences, the people that you interact with, the white European children that you're interacting with, or young adults or colleagues at work that you're interacting with, they've also been socialized very, very different. Because insofar as, for example, history is whitewashed to remove the sins of, you know, their European ancestors, it's going to mean that you're just going to have different reference points. Because when you're getting the history of how your ancestors came to be in European countries, they're not getting the same information. In fact, they're getting very wildly different information that absolves them, that makes it seem as though you haphazardly happen to be there, that ignores the fact that the reason why most people of color are in white countries is a direct consequence of colonization and slavery. They are getting a very different history and a very different social conditioning, which means that how they view themselves is going to be different to how you view them. And it also means how they view you is going to be very different to how you view yourself, in a way that can be seen in these clashes where, for example, people, when they're talking about how ancient artifacts that were taken from African and Asian and Latin American countries, how they should be sent back to those places, how people have different views depending on where their ancestors came from, or how, for example, some people don't understand the need for Black History Month, or why they don't understand why it's important to talk about ethnicity and race, because it obviously massively impacts your economic output. Outcome and impact so many facets of people's lives. You just are coming from two radically different viewpoints in a way that really, to both people, reinforces that idea that you're both different, because obviously you are different. So that identity crisis is being all the time aggravated by all these factors that remind you that as much as you want to belong or be a part of and seamlessly fit into these European countries, all these things always remind you of the fact that you're never going to be 100% accepted. Now, the second part of the identity crisis comes not from the European countries not accepting you as being European. It comes from the fact that when people become older usually and they start to want to explore their ancestral roots and they think, I want to go back to Africa, I want to go back to India, wherever you know, you come from, they go there with great enthusiasm and that they've watched videos and they've read things and they have a certain sense of expectation of what it's going to be. And probably for most people, they think it's going to feel like a welcoming home, like a warm embrace. And sometimes when they get to these places, they don't quite feel the way they imagined they were going to feel for many factors. Sometimes it's just a culture shock in that they've grown up in relatively wealthy countries, and then suddenly they're confronted with the fact that not everybody is living the same kind of life, in that there's poverty elsewhere. There's poverty, there is inequality, there is a lower standard of living, in a way that even though you know it intellectually, it feels different when you're there. It feels confronting. And in many ways, people want to sort of retreat back into their comforts, and they want to sort of disassociate, I guess, because sometimes you don't want to associate with something that is fundamentally sad or fundamentally depressing or fundamentally reminds you of the inequality that exists in the world. And, you know, even outside that, you know, when people go, what you'll realize is that there is going to be a difference. When you go to your origin country or the country of your parents' birth or your native country or your original country, what you realize is that you are going to be different in many respects in that you've just been socialized differently. You've grown up with different cultural points. You've grown up with different worldviews. You've grown up in a very relatively privileged environment. And so all those factors are going to make you feel as though you didn't have the same upbringing and same experiences as the people that you're now with, even though they look like you. And probably for a lot of people, that's where the disappointment comes, because growing up in white countries where people generally look different than you, you kind of have this expectation that when you finally go quote unquote home, you're finally going to like be amongst your people. They look like you, they probably sound like you, they might have similar habits that you might have gotten from your parents, so you might recognize those habits in them as well. So you just expect to seamlessly sort of fit in. And when that doesn't happen, when you still feel that difference, when you still feel that disconnect, when you still feel that alienation from your own that you didn't expect, then that can amplify, obviously, the identity crisis even further. However, I would say in many ways, these wounds are self-inflicted. And I say this for three main reasons. The first is that I deeply suspect that many people just carry a level of shame from having been colonized or from having our ancestors being colonized, which breeds in us a level of self-hatred. I say this mostly, I guess, by comparing how people who come from wealthy European countries, no matter where they live, rarely ever seek to be naturalized or to be fully absorbed into the countries they live in. So really they identify as expats until the day they die. So they may live in Botswana, they might live in the US, they might live in any number of countries, but they always identify as being what they are. So a German person living in South Africa, it could be 50 years later, it could be 60 years later, and they will still identify as an expat. Or people who live in Zimbabwe, or people who live in Senegal, or people who live, or even in like relatively wealthy countries like Singapore, like British people living in Singapore could be there 50 years, and they're not going to identify as being Singaporean for the most part. For the most part, they still identify as being expats. So I always find it curious that people of color living in the white world are so keen to identify with Europeans. And sometimes to me, it feels as though that desperation comes from a deep desire to abandon what they really are, because they sense or they feel on some level that identifying or being European is better than being, for example, African to them. I think also that desperation to fit in is that although people can recognize on an intellectual level that European history isn't good, and that's putting it lightly, I think that belief isn't deeply ingrained. I think if people truly recognized how shameful, how evil, how brutal European colonization was, and how long it went on for, and all the terrible things that they did, and they felt that at the soul level, not just at the intellectual level, I think there'll be less of a desire to want to identify with that culture, because ultimately you can't pick and choose which part. You can't just have the wealthy part and the technologically advanced part without also just having the extended history of violence, not for even good cause, just for economic gain. And so sometimes I feel like people are willing to diminish or to minimize that component because they're so keen and desperate to associate with the wealth and with the power that comes with being able to say, I am British or I am German. Because for them, the money part, the power part, the wealth part outweighs the evil part in a way. Otherwise, they wouldn't be so keen, or otherwise they would have a more balanced view of how they perceive the European identity. And then also connected to that is, in the same way that they are desperate to attach themselves to the power and the wealth and the advancement that comes with identifying with European culture, they're equally repulsed by generalized poverty, in that in everyday, usually, even for example on a micro level, how many people will view homelessness on an individual level and they will blame the individual for their homelessness. They will say, if you worked harder, if you're not trying to get a job, you know, you're lazy, they'll put all these individualized levels of responsibility on that person, as opposed to seeing it as a systemic issue where, for example, drug addiction isn't treated as a healthcare crisis and it's sort of blamed on the individual, or how they don't see, for example, the foster care to drug addiction pipeline, I guess you could say. And I feel that that's the same thing that takes place when people have a general general repulsion towards the poor, where they fundamentally view the poor as being poor because of their own moral failings or their own inadequacy. And I feel like on the whole, I've heard a lot of conversations where if you listen closely, you can hear that that's what they're saying when it comes to the underdevelopment of poorer countries. So they'll look at Africa, for example, or African countries or Asian countries, and they'll say things like, the reasons why Africa is poor, for example, is because there's poor work ethics, or it's because they're having too many children, or it's because they're too busy blaming Europeans for their underdevelopment. All kinds of things that completely disconnect the impact of several centuries worth of colonization, and also the neo-colonization that still takes place today, where European countries band together to ensure that their formerly colonized territories remain in the same economic conditions as they always have. And so when they look at these, when people have sort of like a general repulsion for poverty, look at like poor countries, and they basically blame these poor countries for their own condition, it also has a real impact on how they view themselves when they're from these places. It's not a neutral effect. It's an expression in many ways of self-hatred. And it's an expression of shame as well that feeds itself in other ways, in how they choose, therefore, to identify. If they are perceiving these countries as being poor because, you know, like they can't get it together, then of course they're going to feel a level of shame from identifying with places that they perceive as being weak or being underdeveloped because of their own failings. Now, the second reason why I would say that this identity crisis is to some extent self-inflicted is because when people who have grown up in European countries or socialized in European countries end up eventually going, you know, quote unquote, back home, often they end up actually alienating their home country and the people they come across in those home countries in many ways. One of those ways is that they just fail to fit in almost by design. So usually when we go to a place on holidays or for a trip, we often have this notion of do as the Romans do, because we essentially want to fit in and we want to ingratiate ourselves into the host country, and therefore we take on their customs and their way of living while we're there. And this is particularly true when we are trying to ingratiate ourselves into a culture that we perceive as being valuable or being superior in some way. And that's very much the reason why, for example, people who don't speak French will make sure that they pronounce like French designers properly, because for them, pronouncing these French designers properly is a sign of association with what they perceive as being something worthwhile being associated with. No, so you'll get like a situation where people like don't speak a lick of French, but somehow they can say like Louis Vuitton, they can say like Christian Dior, they can say like Yves Saint Laurent, they'll say Givenchy, and they'll say it with like the right accent, or they'll research how to pronounce it properly because they don't want to be embarrassed. And also they want to fit in. They want to be accepted. They want to be like the French, part of the French, because they obviously perceive the French as being worthwhile culturally, historically, and all the connotations of power that comes from being associated with a country or a culture that's been associated with, for example, the Enlightenment or with philosophy or with like fine art. So they make that effort, they do as the Romans do, because they perceive the Romans, quote unquote, as being worthy of making that effort. In the same breath, those same people will make no effort whatsoever to get to learn their native tongue. So even if they didn't grow up in that country, they can still make an effort to like learn certain words, to learn certain greetings, in the same way that when, for example, you're going to Germany for the first time, you make an effort to learn like how to say hello, how are you? How do I get to the train station? How do I get to the bus station? They just make significantly less effort when it's their native countries. And most of that is driven by the fact that they don't view that country as being as worthwhile as making the same effort as they do for European countries. So obviously going to these countries in which they make no effort, of course, people from there are not going to be as enamored with them, because everybody wants to know that people coming to your country are making an effort to get to know you and to get to know your customs and get to know your language. So when you as like the African person or the Asian, whatever it is, finally go home, quote unquote, for the first time, and you haven't made any effort whatsoever to speak the language or to get to know at least some few, like a key few words to be able to communicate with people, then of course, that's not going to ingratiate yourself with your host country, because again, that communicates to them that it's not worth making an effort to get to know them and to try and blend in, essentially. Another way in which like people of color can alienate their home countries is just in the way that they don't make an effort to take an interest in like renowned people from those places. So on the one hand, they'll idolize and take an interest in white public personalities or European public personalities. So when you think, for example, how many people of color really like fawned over and maybe low-key worship like Queen Elizabeth in her day, where they would know like the names of like the royal family, the grandsons, the history, the ancestors. So they will make an effort to get to know intimately, you know, like the history and the trivia of, you know, people who are responsible for great sufferings of their ancestors, people who are like responsible for the fact that their ancestors were raped and murdered and dispossessed of their land and homes and wealth. They'll make an effort for them. But when it comes time to, for example, taking an interest or getting to know like Nigerian or Indian princesses and princes, then somehow those people aren't real princesses or princes because they're not associated with the European identity. Or another thing that I always notice that I feel alienates like the home country hosts is that when it comes to European etiquette, for example, they'll respect European etiquette. So every place has their own form of eating and what's considered polite. So when they're in European countries, especially like countries like England, they'll use the right cutlery for the right dishes. So you know how it starts out with like the little forks and knives on the outside, and then it becomes like bigger knives and forks. And you're supposed to use like different ones for like each dish that comes out when it's like multiple courses. So they'll watch YouTube videos, they'll read books on what the proper etiquette is, because they don't want to not fit in, because they don't want to be rude to their guests, and also because they, you know, let's say it, perceive that etiquette as being sophisticated and worthwhile getting to know. However, when it comes time to blending in with the etiquette of their home countries when they go home, then all of a sudden they kind of turn their nose up at it. An example is that, for example, even when it comes time to like very similar foods, exact same foods. So when it comes time to like escargot in France, they'll think, oh, this is a little bit like weird, but it's like so sophisticated. So they'll make an effort to try a little bit, even if it's like something they're just not used, their palate isn't used to, they'll still make an effort. When it comes time to go into Nigeria, for example, and having snails, then they won't make an effort, or they'll be rude, or they'll say it's disgusting. And really this difference in attitude towards very similar food comes about because they have one perception of things connected to European identity, and they've got a different perception to things that are connected to cultures that they consider inferior. And that's why they're not willing to make the effort to get to have the right etiquette or to be as open-minded and adventurous and polite as they would in European contexts. Another example as well that grinds me is when it comes to like eating with your fingers. So it's not as though we're against the concept of eating with our fingers, because for most people, when they go to like a pizza joint, like you'll have your pizza with your hands. You'll pick up like a sloppy piece of pizza and you'll fold it in two and you'll eat it with your hands. Or let's say like most people will not have a burger with a knife and fork. They'll pick up their burger and they'll have it with their fingers. So the idea of eating with your fingers is pretty normal. It's very, very normal. Or even when you go to a function, like a work function, and they have like those finger foods. I mean, sometimes they have like those little like skewers that you skewer the little entrees with. But for the most part, like you just lift it with your fingers and it's no big deal. Like you take a napkin, you clean yourself up when you eat. However, when you go to countries where it's customary like countries in poor countries where it's customary to eat with your fingers, then all of a sudden they make it a big deal. Like, instead of just being like, okay, well, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans do, and being polite to the hosts and being sure to not alienate or embarrass or be disrespectful to other people around your eating in ways that are completely normal to them, you'll make a big deal about requesting a knife and fork because you can't have like your pounded yam with your fingers because you're too good for that. Even though back home in European countries, you eat with your fingers all the time, and there's no feelings of inferiority or wanting to sort of show that you're better than that in those contexts, because again, you don't inherently perceive European customs as being primitive or unsophisticated, and so you're willing to go along with what is polite to do or what is normal to do. Or like an example, like, you know that you're going to be going somewhere that is like, people are not going to be wealthy, they're going to like be relatively poor. Let's say you're going to visit like relatives, like your parents are taking you to your relatives in like the village somewhere, and you know damn well these people do not have a lot of money, but somehow you are going to insist on bringing like your expensive camera, you're gonna wear your nice jewelry, you're gonna wear like your nice clothes. So again, like, all these things are like subtle forms of reminding the people around you that you are not like them and that you are better than them, because otherwise you would just try and fit in. Like, even outside the etiquette question, just within the context of being sensitive to people's situations, you normally blend in. Like, you're not going to go to somewhere where people don't have money and then you're going to be like flashing the fact that you have relatively more money than them. That's just an insensitive thing to do, even outside the etiquette question of like doing as the Romans do when you're in people's countries. So again, all these things are subtle, if unconscious, forms of trying to differentiate yourself against the people that you're amongst, your own people. And people usually aren't offended because you're different or because you're wealthy. What they're offended by is the fact that they can sense, they can smell it off you, that you are trying to remind them or make them feel inferior because you have more money or because you were raised in European countries. And that's what makes them not connect with you. And that's what makes them feel as though you, in many ways, are as just as white supremacist as the tourists that come and condescend to them in their home countries. And so that makes them unable to absorb you into their own culture and to take you on as one of their own, because at every opportunity you're trying to remind them of those two facts of you being different and you being better than them. And of course it's natural that they're going to be defensive about it as well, and they are going to treat you as different because that's what you are insisting upon. Now, the final reason that I'll talk about why I think it's self-inflicted is that in your heart of hearts, you know that you're not from that country. Now, most people, and I would say like 99.99% of people, like, they know, like, your origin and your ethnic or genetic makeup is kind of intrinsic. So we all know what people from Africa look like. We know what people from Asia look like. We know what people from Eurasia look like. We know what people from South America look like. And we also know what people from Europe look like. So, and even though there might be a range in how people from all those individual regions that I just listed look like, for the most part, they conform to a certain like look, to a certain phenotype, to a certain, you know, a general look. And if you were to ask like the average person, if they were unobserved, there was no consequences to their answer, they didn't have to be politically correct, if you ask them, what does an African look like? They would describe an African person as you imagine an African person to be. You ask them what an Asian person looks like, they might describe somebody from India, they might describe somebody from Singapore, they might describe somebody from Vietnam, but they will describe a person that largely conforms to the people who come from those regions. And that's also true when it comes to describing what a European looks like. And so while people might be trained to publicly give the right answer or to publicly pretend not to notice what the differences are, in safe circles and in their heart of hearts, they don't necessarily believe that. They don't believe that Europeans look like Africans or that Asians look like Europeans. They've got a very definitive view of what it means to be African or European or Latin American or Asian. And that's also true from people from those regions as well. I also know what it means to look like African people. That's why there is that discussion, for example, around South Africa, where people always distinguish South Africans from white South Africans, because they're trying to dog whistle to you that there is obviously a difference. And ultimately, if you were to take children who aren't concerned about being politically correct or who don't fear the ramifications of giving the wrong answer, and you were to ask them what a European person looks like, what an African person looks like, what an Asian person looks like, you know, they'll be pretty open and straightforward about that answer. And that would align with what most people in their heart of hearts know those people to traditionally or typically look like. And a simple analogy is if you were to a family of lions, shall we say, and you had that family of lions live amongst pandas for generations, it's not as though those lions become pandas just because of exposure to living with pandas. They would still just be, years later, lions that live amongst pandas. Now, obviously, I know in real life, things are more complex than that, and that people, for example, have interracial relationships where they produce biracial children, and those experiences are much more complex. But outside more simple examples that I've given in the episode, where you have a situation where, you know, it's monoculture families, it's like African families where both parents are African, their children are African, they just happen to have been born and raised within European context, I guess I find it confusing that they should easily give up their identities and seek so desperately to identify with something that they just visually do not conform to and aren't really. Now, all of this is not to say that we as African people who have been born and raised in European contexts, you know, shouldn't be entitled to citizenship or like the same legal protection or to the same opportunities. It doesn't even necessarily mean that we need to vocalize this discussion to outsiders. I feel like this is very much an in-house discussion, like a closed curtain discussion. But I do feel like a lot of the desperation to imprint ourselves with the European identity really is driven from that sense of inferiority and shame that comes from being a people that were conquered. And also just in modern context, that effect of colonization and conquering or having been conquered, visible, you know, maybe things would be different or people would be more inclined to identify differently if Africa was just as wealthy as Europe, if Africa or Asia's level of economic development was on par with European development, or even outside economic development, if, for example, we had just as many heroes, like African heroes and Asian heroes, because our history hadn't been washed away or manipulated or hidden, where you really need to go digging to find the truth to many of these things, then I deeply suspect that many people would have a lot more pride in identifying as their own origin countries. You know, they'd be much more likely to identify as African or Asian over identifying as European, because there will be no cachet, there will be no reason really to abdicate from your own identity in favor of something that will never really embrace you as one of their own. And there's so many amazing reasons why it's simpler and it's freeing to identify with your actual true identity, because a lot of the cognitive dissonance, as I described in the episode, comes from straddling those two identities. Like, you're so desperate to be European, but you don't look European. Your history is different. The Europeans perceive you as different because you are different. And then at the same time, you want to belong to your own country of birth or of your parents' birth, but you're also alienating them, and you're only alienating them because you're really desperate to fit into European culture. All that mental turmoil goes away when you make a choice and say, actually, I am African. I am an African person from an African country. That's why I look this way. That's why my parents look this way. That's why I've got a very particular history. And that history and that identity and the way that I look is not inferior. It's not in competition with. It just is. And when you choose one identity, that identity that most reflects you, the identity where you don't have to constantly fight yourself because you don't look and you don't have the same past as what you're trying to sort of like morph into, all that mental fog, all that cognitive dissonance, all that battle within yourself melts away. And it's a very liberating experience. Another reason is that the racists can't weaponize that against you, because one of their trump cards that they have is that they can always hurt you by reminding you that you are not one of them. And when that moment arises, when you see like a racist rally where they're talking about immigrants and there's pictures of people who look like you, that always hurts fundamentally, because they can weaponize the fact that no matter how hard you try and how much you want to be part of that identity or part of that group, you will never be fully embraced and incorporated and accepted as that group. And that's a stick they can beat you over with over and over again, because they can see in you that insecurity and that desperation for acceptance. And so when you let go of that, you also take away their power to hurt you, because what does it matter if you say that I'm not Irish, for example, because I identify as insert whatever country you're from. And finally, you just start to see your own heritage and your own history and your own culture through a different lens, a more positive lens, a more empowered lens. And when you start to feel good about your own roots and your own culture and where you come from, it kind of opens up the people who respond to you. Because when you're in that self-hatred mode and you're going to your home country and you're communicating all the self-hatred to people, obviously it alienates lots of people, and many of those people are people who could actually teach you about your history, teach you about your language, teach you about your culture. And actually what you will find is that that enthusiasm and that embrace for your own culture is going to be reciprocated. And what you'll find is that acceptance, that feeling of that warm embrace, of feeling like you don't have to be self-aware because you blend in, and you blend in because you are communicating that I am just like you and you are just like me. And that level of not having to second guess your actions, of being fully accepted, is really what most people who grow up in European countries ultimately crave, because it's that one feeling they've never been able to satisfy, because they've always grown up in an environment in which they're reminded in small and big ways that they don't quite belong. And with that wraps up this week's episode. Thank you so much for tuning in. I would really love to hear your thoughts on this episode in particular. Send me an email. I'll leave it in the episode notes, and I'll catch you on the next one.